The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy, and how you can make the most of your own life, right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan, and I have what may be a very exciting show for you today. I've been thinking a lot lately about what it takes to make change in one's life. Not change in the usual psychotherapeutic concept of you're going to get over being depressed or get over having ADHD or get over being obsessive compulsive, because I don't think that way, and it's not the approach that I think helps people. But what I've really been seeing lately in my practice and in my life is people changing their lives. People who are literally facing conflict, disappointment, hurt, injury, and making something better out of it, making a truly better life. This is one of the most important concepts that we can have. That we as individuals, when we're facing difficulties, when we feel overwhelmed, when we feel disappointed, when we feel betrayed, that we actually are receiving signals that it's time to grow. It's time to find new ways of approaching life. It's time to do something more wonderful, more creative, more satisfying than we've done before. I recently have had a similar experience to that of many of the people that I know and people in my practice, in that an organization that I had led for decades until 2002 with my wife Ginger since the 1980s, when we no longer felt welcome there. We were emeritus. We were supposedly the wise sages doing our best to lend a hand and help. We felt very unwelcome, and we had to face, what do we do when the organization we have built for all these years no longer met our standards and really wanted and preferred to not have our overarching presence in their organizational life? It was a huge disappointment. It was associated with various kinds of feelings of anger, outrage, betrayal, and led to some considerable conflict. But in the process, we realized that what had been going on was really longer term than we realized, and that we really weren't getting what we wanted out of our public professional life. I was continuing to love my private practice and writing books and doing blogs and eventually the radio show, doing legal work. But I had withdrawn from a lot of my reaching out to the public. And Ginger Bragan, my wife, who's always been my connection to the world, she had withdrawn too from that role, because we had associated those activities with the organization that I founded and that we had led for so many years. So we decided to move on. And so at the age of 74, and my wife 14, 15 years younger, we created a new organization, the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, which became the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, Education, and Living. Because we began more and more to see one coherent whole of therapy and life and the practice of ethical, empowering ways of being. And I found myself meeting new people, one of whom is my guest today, Pamela Glasner, and another, a friend I've been recently emailing with about coming to our conference in April, Brazilian psychiatrist, not Brazilian, Alberto Ferguson, Colombia, South America psychiatrist, who I've been emailing back and forth with today about his arrangements to come to our new conference, making contacts with old friends, making new friends, getting new ideas, being inspired to write new blogs, being inspired in the radio show. So out of what was a dreadful summer of disillusionment and disappointment with people I had known for years, out of that came a new reaching out to new people with new ideas, with more creativity, with more initiative. People more compatible with me and me more compatible with them. And again, my guest, Pamela Glasner, is one of those folks. Now, originally, Pam and I were going to talk about children first, because we're both dismayed by the abuse of children. Recent continuing disclosures about how many of them are on psychiatric drugs. But as I listen to my patients today, my clients or patients, and as I thought more about myself and my wife and what we've been through, I realized that Pamela is a paragon, a paradigm, an exemplar of how to begin growing anew and in new directions. And so that's what I'm going to talk about today. I'm going to talk about taking stress, taking conflict, taking aging, and turning it into a new and exciting life. Now, will I get a chance to do it with Pamela Glasner? Are you there, Pam? Pam? Pamela is not on the line yet.
No, I am. Can you hear me?
Yeah, what happened to you, darling?
I don't know. I'm here.
Oh, thank God you're there.
Yeah.
I was thinking, okay, Peter, you're going to have to talk about yourself and Ginger for the rest of the hour.
No, I wouldn't abandon you.
Now, this is my friend, Pamela Glasner. She's been on the show once before, and it was so good. I thought I'd have her on again, but we didn't talk about any of these issues. Pamela is an author. She's published a book of historical fiction, Finding Emmaus. It's a wonderful and exciting book. I've done what were those things, Pamela? What do you call those things we did?
Book signings,
book presentations together. The only person I've ever done that with, and we've had a good time when we've done that. Pamela will be coming to our annual conference in April in Syracuse, New York, which you can find out about on empathictherapy.org. You can go to my website, Bregin.com, Bregin.com, or empathictherapy.org. Pamela, did you get to listen to my introduction?
I listened to every single word of it.
Oh. Well, then, run with it.
Run with it. Okay. Well, it's interesting that you were talking about, having change come, positive change from your life, come out of something that is incredibly stressful. I guess we all experience that. A good friend of mine by the name of Barbara likes to refer to that as the cosmic boot, which I think is pretty apropos. I have a strong background, in my Christianity, and I just believe that it was time for me to change, even though I didn't really, maybe I wasn't so sure that it was time for me to change, but I knew something was coming, and I went to a silent retreat, and in that retreat, what I realized at the retreat, once we went into silence, was how wonderful it was to not have to do all the necessary chit-chat, and how nice it was to not have all this noise bombarding me. But once I didn't have all that external stuff bombarding me, what I realized was that there's a hell of a lot more internal noise that bombards me constantly than the external. And it's all that internal stuff, I think, that, at least in my case, that kept me from being what I could be, from seeing what I could be. It's just so easy to get distracted and get pulled here and pulled there and, you know, dealing with your everyday life and whatever. And that weekend just had this amazing effect on me. I've been a writer like all my life, but I'd never written a book. And, you know, I used to write. I've been writing things for as long as I can recall, but I always wanted to write a book, but I never thought that, I used to sit in front of my pad, sit with a pad in my lap, or then eventually sit in front of my computer and wonder, what could I ever have to say for 350 or 450 pages that anybody would be interested in listening to? And then I went away for a weekend to this silent retreat, and I came home, picked up a pen, and didn't stop for 5 months. And 5 months and, you know, 765 pages later, I had a novel. So and that wasn't necessarily something terribly stressful, although it was outrageously stressful for the rest of my family because they all thought I'd gone nuts. But it was dramatic, and in a lot of ways it was scary because I went from being one sort of person to all of a sudden a completely different kind of person. And it was actually it was scary for me to deal with, but it was kind of backwards from you, where you guys had this stressful thing happen to you and change came out of it. I was kind of the other way around. This dramatic change came over me, and then the reaction of my friends and my closest friends and my family and my community to my dramatic change was stressful, and I had to almost learn how to stand my ground and say, you know, I don't know why I'm being led to do this, but this is what's happening. And it's been tough, but now that I'm kind of like on the other side of that, and I have written a book, and I've written a couple of short stories, and I have two films coming. Now people are saying, oh, well, you know, now they're kind of seeing, it's not like vindication or anything like that. It's just, well, you know, this is what Pamela went through. This is the changes. And I guess this is the reason why all of these things happened to her, because she had these stories to tell and kind of like this mission in life, for lack of a better term.
There's a ton of stuff here to talk about. Let me take you back to when you decided to go on a retreat. Now, that usually means that a person is dissatisfied, searching. So while you may not have been stressed, something was going on that you went on a retreat and discovered the static in your head.
Yes. I went on my retreat with I did have some stuff going on in my life, and somebody in my parish had said, why don't you come on the silent retreat with us? And I thought, oh my gosh. I mean, I could not imagine me, and you have to know me in order to appreciate this. I talk all the time. And the thought of me being silent for, like, you know, 3 consecutive days was scary to me. I couldn't imagine. I didn't think I'd even be successful at it. And I mean, it sounds like I'm joking, but the truth is that I really was afraid of, you know, whether or not I'd be able to do something like that. But I went there with a particular problem, a particular issue in mind, thinking, well, maybe if I go there and I pray on it and I meditate on it and things are just nice and quiet and I'm not distracted, that maybe I can come home with an answer. And so...
Can you tell us the problem?
Not something I would want to say on the air, though.
No, that's fine. Go ahead.
We went into silence Friday night at 9 o'clock. And so halfway through the retreat would have been Saturday afternoon. And I remember thinking, wow, I'm halfway through this retreat. I only have tomorrow left. And I'm no closer to an answer than I was
when I left my driveway, and I was very frustrated and very, you know, upset about that, thinking that I wasn't doing a good job at this at all. And then, but I was writing the whole time that I was gone. For some reason, I brought my pad and pen with me, and I had not really sat down to write literally in years. I mean, I do, you know, graphic stuff for people, brochures and that kind of thing, but I hadn't sat down to write something, you know, from the gut or from the heart in years. And so I just kept writing and writing and writing, and I didn't know why I was writing and writing, but I wrote something like 20 pages in 24 hours. And then after it was all done, and this, it was almost like a cathartic release. And then we came out of silence Sunday after lunch. And then I realized that I had my answer. But not only did I realize I had my answer, I realized that I had had my answer, that I had known what it was before I ever left my driveway on Friday. But there was just so much noise, external and internal noise, that I never let myself hear it and see it and feel it, if that makes any sense to you.
Yeah, are you talking about the answer to the problem?
The answer to the problem, yes. I knew it all along. I just didn't let myself know I knew it.
Okay. And did it have anything to do with writing, becoming a writer?
It had absolutely nothing to do with writing, no. But I think that that weekend and the writing, the exercise of writing, was what made me realize that writing is not just a thing I do. Writing is something that I am. It's one of the most... aside from my family and my faith, it's one of the most important things in my life, and I've never allowed myself to have that. And I think combining this, the writing, with this cathartic release, and having that be the thing that pushed me into realizing what the answer was, and then combining that with the fact that, oh my God, this is something that just does wonders for me, and that I really, really love. I mean, it was all kind of, you know, tied in together, and I just knew from that minute that I was going to go home and write a book, and it was just the weirdest thing, because I'd been wanting to for so long, and I never believed that I could. And then when I got home and I picked up my pad, I write everything longhand, and I picked up my pad and started writing my book, from that moment on, I honestly could not recall why I thought all these years, I'm 57 years old now, and I honestly couldn't recall why I thought all these years that I could not write a book.
I genuinely believe that every human being has some aspect, if not many aspects, of life that they can connect to the way you're describing. You know, writing has always been that way for me. I used to joke, but quite seriously, in my darkest moments, which were pretty dark before I met Ginger in my 40s, so I had a lot of darkness to go through until I got together with Ginger in my 40s. I met her earlier. I used to say if I could just drag myself to the typewriter, there were typewriters in those days, that I'd be okay. And there was just a lot of truth to that. And then I used to think, if I just had a woman to love and be loved by, really to love is how I thought of it, and a typewriter, I could live on an island and be completely happy. And now you've met that woman, and I have a woman to love and be loved by, and I not only have a typewriter, I got a computer, and I got friends, and I got many other things. You really can build a good life. It takes different kinds of courage at different stages of a life. Now, one of the things that's so striking to me about you, and this is Dr. Peter Breggin talking with Pamela Glasner, the author of Finding Emmaus, and a dear friend of mine and of Ginger Breggin, my wife. One of the striking things about you is how much you connect to that world. You reach out, you connect online, you publicize yourself. A year ago you were in the middle of finishing your book or writing your book, and now you got films. Is this a whole new energy for you?
It is. It's a whole new everything for me. It's, and that's part of why it was so scary. There is, I suppose, at my core, I am basically the same person I've been all my life. But there are so many things about me that are different. And my sister says, well, Pamela, what you are now is probably what you were always meant to be, and there was just too much garbage in the way. I don't know if that's, I mean, that could possibly be it. But probably, but almost everything about me is different. I literally, I mean, I look different. I eat different foods. I enjoy different things. I have a whole new set of friends. And it's as though I had this rebirth. And it was terrifying to me. I mean, there were times when I really was wondering if I was losing my mind. And I remember sitting in my priest's office. I spent a lot of time with him because he's, you know, bless his heart, he is a very patient man. And he, you know, he helps me work through things. He doesn't give me answers. He helps me work through them. And I remember telling him that I was afraid that I was losing my mind because I was looking in the mirror and saying, who is this human being? And he assured me multiple times that people do not lose their minds all of a sudden without warning for absolutely no reason, so I wasn't crazy. But whatever path I was on, I was meant to be there. And the proof of that is that I was there. And that was...
he sounds like an amazing man. I'm afraid that most priests, rabbis, and ministers would have referred you to a psychiatrist. What do you think the outcome would have been of that?
Oh, well, I'm not an easy... Fortunately, I am not an easy person to refer to a psychiatrist. I grew up raised by a pharmacist, and even though... I mean, and we were always, you know... I don't know. It was kind of weird. I grew up being raised by a pharmacist, but I did not grow up with the thought that everything is solved by a drug. But because I grew up with a pharmacist, I grew up with an understanding of what all that stuff was. And I did. I was at one point, in fact, many years ago, referred to a doctor who tried to prescribe Valium to me. He was a neurologist. I was having dizzy spells. And it took them a while to realize I had TMJ or whatever that's called, and I had to have surgery. But this doctor tried to give me Valium, and I asked him, I said, I mean, I didn't know much about Valium, but I knew that I had heard that it was very addictive. And this was, I mean, this was, you know, I was in college at the time. And he said, so I questioned him, and this was way before all of those campaigns on TV and on the radio and whatnot about, you know, people should get more involved in their, in you know, their medical treatments and whatnot. This was back when that guy with the stethoscope, he said something and he was God. And so he wanted to give me these drugs, and I said, well, I don't really want them because I've heard that they're very addictive. And he got furious with me that I would have the temerity to argue with him. And he slapped his prescription pad down on the counter and said, that's absolutely ridiculous. He says, you have no idea how many of my patients have been taking these for how many years. And I didn't even, I mean, I don't even know if the guy realized how ridiculous that was. You know, this drug isn't addictive. My patients have been taking these things for years. And then he threw me out of his office.
So, what a blessing. The best thing that can
now
happen
nowadays was a blessing. Back
to anybody
then, I didn't
is to
know
be
you're,
thrown
you know,
out of the doctor's office when they offer psychiatric drugs.
Well, I was thrown out of his office because I wasn't going. He said, if you're not going to listen to me, then what are you doing here?
Yeah.
You know, so.
Yeah.
But you're right. I am lucky that I have, and I don't know if it's luck. I personally think that God takes very good care of me.
I've often thought that myself. You know, when I was very young, in my 30s, people often came who got to know me and knew what I was taking on, the drug companies, the AMA, the American Psychiatric Association, the government, an individual. I was taking on individuals of great power, heads of departments of neurosurgery, calling them out on doing psychosurgery, following up their patients, following up the psychosurgeon's patients and reporting on them because the patients were coming to me. And life was very dangerous. And people would say, you have an angel on your shoulder.
Yeah.
Well, I don't know about angels, but I do feel that that there is a providence, and that when we're brave and we do what we believe in for ourselves and ultimately for others, because what we do in for ourselves, if it's meaningful, is always, I believe, for others as well, that we're safer than we think. At the time, we may be terrified, but we're really safer than we think. And I get the sense that you view things in that same fashion.
Yeah, I was afraid. I don't think I ever felt especially unsafe, but I felt like I wasn't necessarily walking on solid ground, but it never stopped me. I wasn't ever afraid enough to not move forward. So maybe that's a good way to put it, because I did feel, I think I was afraid mostly because it was unfamiliar, not because I felt unsafe. And I guess there's a distinction there.
Do you want to say more, and perhaps you don't, about what it was like as you were changing and the people closest to you resisted, were frightened for you perhaps, didn't know what to make out of it? Maybe you've said enough about that. I mean, I do want you to keep your privacy, but would you like to say more about that? Because I think that it's a common experience for people, whether they're coming off psychiatric drugs, deciding to become writers, taking on new challenges, quitting a job, trying to do what they really believe in, that others around them will resist, will become frightened, and may even become destructive.
Actually, there is something that I wanted to say. Did you ever see, it was just an accident that I kind of came across this again. Do you remember the movie The Dead Poets Society with Robin Williams and...
Oh, yes. Seize the Day.
Yes, and it was...
What was that in Latin?
Carpe Diem.
Carpe Diem, seize the day.
And
there goes my 4 years of Latin in high school.
There goes your 4 years of Latin in high school. That's right. Your teacher is going to come back from the grave.
Oh, Mrs. Kelty, I apologize. She was the best teacher I ever had. She really was.
Yeah.
But go ahead.
Well, one of the characters, the one that's played by Robert Sean Leonard, the kid's name is Neil, he realizes at one point in, he realizes during the school year that his love is acting, and his father has already decided that he is going to, I believe, medical school. I believe that's what he was going to do. He was going to become a doctor or a lawyer or something. Whatever dad wanted wasn't what the kid wanted. So, and in its extreme, I mean, obviously this is in the absolute extreme, he doesn't see any choices. He's absolutely devastated that he cannot have his love, and he commits suicide. And I mean, I never had any thoughts of suicide or anything like that, but I do remember that my family, some of my family, not all of my family, some of my family members strongly resisted what I was doing, because partly because dramatic change is frightening to anybody. It was frightening to me. So I didn't know it was happening to me. So I can imagine how scary it must have been to other people to watch this stuff happening. And then when they ask me for an explanation, I can't even give them one. But I think the status quo in most cases, the devil you know is better than the devil you don't. I think the status quo in most cases is people are just comfortable with that, and they don't necessarily want things to change. My life is wonderful, and I don't want you, Pamela, to be rocking the boat. And especially when I don't even know why you're rocking the boat or what the boat's going to look like when you're all finished with it. My brother at one point was very worried for me, because when I write, I don't just sit there and write. I am actually, I feel like I'm there, and not like I believe I'm one of my characters or anything like that, but I have to put myself in the situation in order for me to write effectively. So I can almost see it and hear it and smell it, and then it's almost like I'm living a scene in a movie, and then I just write what I've experienced, and that's how I write effectively. But that it's emotionally draining. So when I'm writing something that is particularly sad, and there's a lot, Finding Emmaus is a very intense book because it's about the treatment and mistreatment of the mentally ill over a course of like 350 years. And it's very intense, and some of it is very sad, and there are some people in, you know, just like in life, there are people in the book who die or whatever. And I really, in order for me to write the emotions of the characters, I have to almost put myself in their shoes. And sometimes I would just sit there and cry as I'm writing. And my brother was really concerned for me. He said, I can't believe what this book is doing to you. And I don't necessarily think it was the book that was doing it to me. I think that it was that I was allowing myself to have this and then putting it on paper, and only instead of saying Pamela's feeling it, you know, this character or that character is feeling it. But I think that the fact that I was able to do this is what makes my book so so real to my readers. I have people writing to me and saying,
Let me interrupt you at that wonderful point. We're getting near the break.
Uh-huh.
And I expect music any minute now. You are listening to Pamela Glasner talking to Peter Bregan, and this is Dr. Peter Bregan, and we'll be back shortly.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bregan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
Hi, I'm Eric Davis, host of Expanding Mind. Join me and co-host Maja Daou each week as we explore the culture of consciousness, spirituality, neuroscience, media tech, and all manner of wonders and esoterica. Expanding Mind streams every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep your mind open.
South of the border.
Hello, I'm Johnny Mueller, and I have a brand new show called The Expat Files, and it's all about living, working, playing, or retiring in Latin America. I know what it's like to buy land, build a house, start a business. I've been through it in a dozen Latin countries. So, if you're thinking about moving down, or you're just curious, be sure to listen in Mondays and Wednesdays, 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time.
Down Mexico way.
The Progressive Radio Network is looking to expand its programming, and we are looking for your ideas. If there's a subject that you are passionate about and we don't cover it, let us know. Give us a call at 646-307-4482 or email our program director, carolee@garynoll.com. That's K-A-R-A-L-E-E at garynoll.com. The Progressive Radio Network, the number one forum for progressive minds.
Freedom News Hour will bring you up to date on the latest news on the financial meltdown.
Begin restoring local communities. It can happen.
We'll be exploring the issues from a freedom-oriented, small government perspective.
I'm Walt Thiessen.
I'm Melinda Pillsbury Foster.
I am Jake Towne.
Join us live Thursday evenings at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Gary Knoll. I've been on radio for 37 years, every day, and I'm pleased that the Progressive Radio Network exists. because this is the one forum that brings together some of the most important, probing, creative, and dynamic minds on the planet. Join us each and every day, 24/7, on the Progressive Radio Network, your home for independent thinking.
You're listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
And this is Dr. Peter Breggin. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N. And I'm talking with my wonderful guest, Pamela Glasner, a dear friend, genuinely a friend, and a marvelous woman. I'm thinking about the subject we're talking about today, which, oh gosh, how would you even characterize it? It's about taking your life to whole new places. It's about doing what you're meant to do. It's about daring to face the fears that keep you from doing what you want to do. It's about meeting the resistance and overcoming the resistance of those around you who may love you or who may not, who may just be jealous of you, who keep you or want to keep you from doing what you need, want, and perhaps are ordained to do. And it's about the importance of what a person along the way can mean to you. And in a minute, I'm going to ask Pamela more about the priest who counseled her, because I think one or more individuals at key moments in our lives can mean a great deal in promoting our doing what we believe in doing. And I think the model that we're talking about is a universal model that really deals with everything in life. Everything in life. I think it deals with growing up as a child and having the courage to be who you are, because I remember even as a child being told by others what I could or couldn't do. Some of you don't know, I've written and published 2 novels. I've won an award for writing a play. And I remember a teacher telling me in junior high that I should, after writing one little piece of dialogue, that I should never try to write dialogue again. Ha ha ha. That I might be good at so many other things as I was, but I better not try writing dialogue. And of course, what a crushing effect it has. So all of us, in the normal development of childhood, we're going to have moments when we have to decide whether we're going to keep pursuing what we believe is interesting, exciting, or who we are, or at least going on and learning more about it. And then there are going to be crises that get called anxiety disorders and clinical depression. I'm sure Pamela thought about how she might have gotten labeled bipolar if she hadn't gone to a priest and gone to a psychiatrist instead, because she was up and down and full of energy and then unsure of herself and so on. I've seen people labeled bipolar for simply having temper tantrums, let alone going through what Pamela was going through. So I think what we're talking today has a lot of universal application to all of our lives, and just can't be overemphasized this importance. So, Pamela, welcome back.
Hi.
What have you been thinking about during the break or in response to what I've been saying? What would you like to talk about now?
Well, I think, first of all, I agree wholeheartedly with you. I think really the point that I wanted to get across is that somewhere inside all of us, whether we let ourselves know it or not, that there is something that we feel that we are meant to be doing. And sometimes people know about it from a very early age. I mean, I've known of people who said, oh, yeah, I knew that I wanted to be a magician from the time I was in grade school, or I knew I wanted to be an actor. And sometimes it takes longer. Like in my case, I started writing Finding Emmaus in 2000. It was published in 2009, so I started in 2008, which means I was 55 years old. 54 going on 55. But I think that if we can get silent and look inside ourselves, we can find out what that is. And sometimes it does take an awful lot of courage, not necessarily to do it, but to be able to stand up for ourselves when we realize, because there are going to be people around us, there are going to be naysayers. If I had listened to every, I specifically did not. I did not ask people if it's possible. That was the one thing that I did not go around. Do you remember the TV show Star Trek?
And of course, everybody remembers that.
Everybody and Captain Kirk used to say, I think, to Spock, don't ever tell me the odds. And I think that makes a lot of sense, because if people had come to me and told me, oh, my God, you can't get published. I mean, especially in this environment, you'll never find an agent. You'll never find a publisher. Nobody's ever heard of you. And then for sure, you'll never get a movie made. You'll never do this and you'll never do that. And not only that, but even if you do, then this, you know. And if I had asked the question, is this possible? It's not that I didn't ask people for advice, and it's not that I didn't meet with people who have, you know, who are already writers and people who are in the film industry, but I never wanted to ask anybody, is this something that I can do? Because I never wanted anybody to say, no, it's not.
I hope the world is listening to you, because what you're saying is so incredibly important. And it's interesting. It comes up in therapy when my client or patient will say, well, you know, what are the odds on ever finding somebody you really love and having a wonderful marriage? I mean, what are the odds on that? And I'll say, well, first of all you have to know is that it happens. It happens. Now, do you want to live the way 99% of people live if they're miserable? Or do you want to go for it? Do you want to go for what you want? And I think the going for what we want is incredibly important. In fact, one of the things I've seen time and again in my own life, my family's life, my patient's life, is that once you've decided to go for what you want, you feel better before you even get there. You feel better the minute you begin the process of going for what you want. And I can't overemphasize that. It can be someone who's been so disappointed in love that they don't want to try to love again. It can be somebody who's had horrible abuse as a child, so they don't dare dream of becoming strong and independent and building their own lives free of abuse. It can be anything that you aspire toward. Once you decide that you do aspire toward something and you begin to work toward it, you are in a whole new place before you get there. And even if you change directions and decide, no, you don't want to get divorced and run off with somebody else. No. You actually want to stay with your husband or your wife and your children. Even though you change your mind, what is important is the decision to go for what you want, to go for love, to go for a responsible life, to go for creativity, to be closer to God, to trust yourself more. All of these things are a process, and you don't even have to get to the end point. I've often felt that about the reform work I do, and Ginger and I talk about this all the time. I don't measure the success of my reform work by the outcome. The outcome is up to society, other people, God, things I don't understand, this time in history. What matters to me is pursuing what I believe in. And when I keep my eye on that, I'm doing just fine. And I'll bet, Pamela, that once you decided to write, that you changed, that you changed before you got published. Am I right about that?
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Oh, absolutely. Because I was sitting in, I belong to a private club here in Connecticut that's in Hartford. And I probably wrote half of the book there. And what I used to be, when I would go to a party, and any kind of, even if it was a family thing, I used to do the best imitation of wallpaper that anybody has ever seen. I always, I've never really been into small talk, and I would go to any kind of an event where there was, you know, more than one human being there, and I would just absolutely freak out. I joined a club, and I did public speaking. Now, I mean, I do presentations about my book all the time, and not only do I speak in front of people, but I've presented in front of a crowd as big as, so far my biggest crowd's been 400 people. And I'm fine. And, you know, I would sit there at the club and I would write, and the fact that I even joined anything like this, I mean, you know, that I would walk right up to people, because the club has all kinds of parties and all kinds of events and all kinds of mixers so that the members can meet each other. And I will just walk up to somebody at an event now, and I will not only find myself at these kinds of things, but I will go out of my way to go to these kinds of things, and I'll just walk up to somebody that I've never met before who I think looks interesting, put my hand out and say, "Hi, I'm Pamela Glasner." Not in 50-something years before then did I do that, and I don't know why I'm suddenly able to. It's not like I sat myself down in front of a mirror one day and said, "Pamela, you are going to start introducing yourself to people."
Pamela, I think it's because you have an identity you believe in and trust now.
Could be.
You know,
but it's not like I went out of my way to
look for that. Of course you can introduce yourself to people.
I'm sorry?
You know who you are, so you can introduce yourself to people.
Oh, actually, I never thought of it that way, but yeah, that's right. Maybe that's it. Maybe now I can say, "Hi, I'm Pamela, and I'm a writer." And I don't know. I'm not sure. I don't exactly say that, but I mean, just
no,
the fact
you know
that
in your heart who you are.
Yes, well, that's true. I mean, that's how I met your wife. I just started talking to her. You know,
how did you start talking to Ginger?
Yeah, I started talking to Ginger. I mean, I didn't know.
How did
Ginger
you meet her?
All.
How did you get in touch with her?
Through Facebook, of course. I've met so many people through
yes.
Facebook. It's, but I mean,
you're a great
I
social networker, like
oh,
my wife.
Oh yeah, yeah. And
I just sit back and enjoy the fruits of it.
Well, your wife is one heck of a good social networker. So, and she and I just started talking, but I never would have had the courage to do something like that. And in fact, you know, Kevin Miller, the person who did Generation RX. I didn't know him from Adam, and yet I found the movie Generation RX online, and I just was so moved and touched by it that I wrote him an email and asked him if he would be willing to write the foreword for my book Finding Emmaus. I never would have done
anything
like
that. Is
that
how you found out about us? Because
yeah.
I think I'm in that, as I recall.
Yeah. I didn't know him from Adam, and I just was so moved by your film. I mean, you know, the documentary that you were in, and that's how I first heard of you.
Yeah.
And I was just so moved by it that I asked him if he would be willing to do this. But he'd never heard of me, and I wrote from the heart in my email. And an hour and a half after I sent in the email, he called me at my house, and we've been friends ever since. I mean, I never in a million years would have done anything like that before.
Now, Pamela, in my work as a therapist, and again, I'm talking with Pamela Glasner, the author of Finding Emmaus, and now becoming the author of the film, or some other films as well. And I'm talking with Pamela about changing our lives, finding what we really believe in doing, and taking responsibility and finding the courage to do it. Now, as a therapist, in that kind of process, I know that people often have to overcome the prohibitions, the denigrations of childhood, the lessons that we mistook from childhood about our limitations. Did you have to go through that on any level?
Well, yeah. I unfortunately grew up in a very violent household, so there was a lot of stuff for me to unlearn. And I'm very, very lucky in that I did have the support of, well, I had people who kind of took me in when I was in high school, and I actually think of them as my mother, my brother, and my sister. And I do have a biological brother who I'm very close with. But these people are, as far as I'm concerned, they're my family. And I had to unlearn all of that, it used to be dangerous for me to show up, for me to stand out. And I'm very fond of saying the problem with being outstanding is that you stand out. And it was very dangerous when I was a kid to stand out. It was a lot safer to just kind of, you know, disappear into the woodwork where I might not get hit. So being an author and being now a filmmaker, I'm very public. And I had to, I had to learn how safe I am.
This is such a universal experience of people coming out of abusive childhoods and being afraid to be seen. Literally, you get used to hiding away so that you won't be seen, so that you won't be misunderstood, so you won't be threatened, so you won't say the wrong thing, get in trouble, see your mother getting hit, or whatever else is going on in that family. And I really believe that the trauma of childhood is often the energy of creativity in adulthood. Never said that sentence before, that the trauma of childhood is the energy of creativity in adulthood. Does that make sense to you?
I think that does make sense. In my
case, it doesn't, tell me where it doesn't make sense.
No, I didn't say it doesn't. I said it does.
Oh, I heard a little hesitation there.
No. I think it makes a lot of sense. In my case, it wasn't my it was my biological mother who was the violent person. So it was a little bit different. But yeah, I think it makes a lot of sense.
That sounds even more confusing than having your father be the violent one instead of your mother.
Well, I don't know. I honestly did not know that everybody didn't get beaten up. I grew up thinking everybody gets beaten up because you don't know any different, you know.
Now, how did you get so wise about the understanding of childhood? Did you have counseling or therapy? Did you read books? How did you get to have such an understanding of where you've come from and where you're going?
I think that has a lot to do with my faith and has a lot to do with the priest that I've been having conversations with and the managing to get myself around people with whom it was safe to be me, to just be, you know. I think God just put me in places where it was okay for me to open up my mouth, and I found out that the rest of the world doesn't kill you. I think a lot of it was when I was in college, and I started being like out, away from my biological family. And like I said, I was fortunate in high school to be taken in by normal people, when I was, you know, towards the end of high school. But once I was in college, I started seeing that the rest of the world doesn't go through that. That, you know, the rest of the, that it's not normal, to be in situations where if you express an opinion which is different from the opinion of the adults in the household, that it's dangerous to do that, so you don't. So it wasn't specifically therapy. I think I just managed to, you know, praise God, get myself into places where it was okay to learn.
Something I've never talked about on the air, you know, you mentioned that when you get out in the world, no one's going to kill you for what you say. You learn that it's not like childhood. Interestingly enough, when I started speaking out in the world, taking on lobotomy and actually, you know, shutting down famous neurosurgeons' lobotomy projects and cutting off their federal funds, I was a relatively young man in my 30s. I found out that what I did and what I said might get me killed. Mm. I got death threats. I had to call the FBI at one point. They went after my medical license for remarks I made on Oprah Winfrey criticizing psychiatry. So I actually faced these enormous threats. But what I found out is the truth of what you're saying, which is even though I was facing real terrifying threats, the real terror was that childhood sense that I would be rejected if I stood up for myself, that I would be unappreciated, that members of the family might be jealous. It went back to the real threats being the family drama that was being stirred up by the real life threats. And when I got better understanding and more sense of where I'd come from and what the effects of my childhood had been on me, I found it much less fearful to risk my life in the real world. And then, as I got older and I gave up being the high school agnostic and the college agnostic and realized that I couldn't possibly be doing what I was doing without providence and without protection, then I got to a new level of feeling that while I might not be safe in the sense I could be injured, I was ultimately safe because I was doing what I was supposed to do. And it's just been amazing to me as I've been doing these radio shows and meeting people and talking about these issues, how much what I used to think was really something to be ashamed of, which was this really beginning to rely on God. You know, it didn't fit with anything I'd grown up with, didn't fit with going to Harvard, didn't fit with a lot of the people who I was doing reform work with. In fact, alienated some of them. That actually, the more I talked about it, the more I found out that there are millions of us, that most of us feel that there's a presence in our lives greater than ourselves. So that's been an enormous lesson for me over the years. But you kind of have been in that place longer than I think.
It was weird for me because I grew up in a Jewish household. Sometimes I think I was born into the wrong family. And I never felt comfortable in the synagogue, but I always wanted to be in a religious house, but I never felt like I belonged there. And then, about 13, 14 years ago, my friend's son was baptized at the church that I go to, and I went to the baptism, and I was just going because they're my friends and I love them. And I walked in and I said, "This is where I belong," and I never left. So I converted. So for me, it was considerably different. But what you're saying about, I mean, you know, what you're saying about the kind of threats that you had, I mean, I have not faced any of that yet. I've had a couple of lunatic cyber stalkers, but nothing like what you've had. And
those are pretty scary, too, though.
They are pretty scary, yes. But yeah, I was thinking when you were talking before about the things that you went through, I think that knowing all the way down to your core that you're where you're supposed to be and doing what you're supposed to be, that whatever comes in from the outside or whatever tries to come in from the outside has less power over you if you feel really secure about what it is that you're doing. And I think that that is about knowing on a visceral level. It's not about knowing in your head. It's about knowing all the way down deep in your gut that, yeah, this is what I need to be doing. And so it's almost as if there's no choice to make. It's not as if I wake up in the morning and then say, I have to make a decision this morning. Do I do this or do I not? It wouldn't occur to me not to do anything else. But what you were saying before about the threats, I mean, I'm thinking to myself, I mean, that's what I spent some time, a considerable amount of time in my book writing about. When you start threatening somebody, you know, when you start going after somebody right in their pocketbook and you start threatening a huge percentage of their billions of dollars of annual income, yeah, they're going to get cranky. And that's really what it's all about. This is what I see you doing is, it's not about somebody drawing a line in the sand and saying, you know, this is my side of the line and that's your side of the line, Dr. Bregan, stay on your own side. What they're saying is, this is my bank account. Because I don't think they really give a damn about anything else but their bank accounts.
Well, it's bank accounts, it's power, it's identity, it's a materialistic religion that they're also defending, which says that you are your biochemicals and there's something the matter with your biochemicals, the new devil theory, the biochemical imbalance and genetics, it's the new devil theory. So it is money, but it's even bigger than money. I've had I've been turned down on projects that book companies knew were going to make money because they were prepared to give me huge advances because they discovered it was against the ideology of the New York climate or against the authority of psychiatry. So I agree with you, the billions make a huge difference, but so does taking on the power, the authority, the cultural values. We're coming near to an end. Pamela Glasner, thank you, thank you, thank you for being on my radio show. You're an inspiration to me, and I hope that someday thousands and millions of people will be listening to this recording, which surely could inspire anyone on the face of this earth. Thank you, Pamela Glasner.
Thank you.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bragan and his lifelong reform work on www.bragan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.